It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
What'd you say your name was again?
Maria Tomchik. Did you get that?
Hey, it's good to have Maria back.
Yeah, Thank you. Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm feeling much better.
That's good. Well, plenty to cover, plenty of stuff happening. Let's start with Greg Nichols getting some...
We were going to talk about the demo.
Yeah, let's start with that, actually. There was significant demonstrations last Saturday, a week ago.
Yeah, you wouldn't have known it by watching TV or picking up the newspaper necessarily, but there were a couple hundred thousand people in D.C., not all of whom were counter-protesters.
Well, expand on that. There was hundreds of thousands in D.C., and there was several thousand at least here in Seattle.
I thought there was at least a couple thousand. It got bigger when it marched.
Yeah.
The rally, I thought, went on way too long. But, that's kind of endemic to these things.
That's standard.
I'm a little bit frustrated because you know the number of people who are opposed to the war here in the Seattle area. With door-to-door canvassing and good grassroots organizing, there's no reason we couldn't turn out 100,000 at one of these marches, particularly with the Bush administration as vulnerable as it is right now, and a number of political developments working against them, and a lot of momentum on the side of withdrawal of troops from Iraq. Now's the time to put on the heat. So let that be a motivator for next time.
Of course, at the same time, it would help if the media were on board
this
a little bit. Because, I was in bed for much of that weekend. And what did I see on TV news or reading the paper? I read about a failed demonstration on Sunday of supporters of the war.
200 people.
Yeah, they had wanted like a 10,000-person turnout. They got 200 people. In my mind, that's a failed demonstration. And that got all the headlines. And I was pretty disgusted with that. I mean, certainly I could go online and see on the wire service reports that there were 100,000 to 200,000, maybe more, people in Washington, D.C., tens of thousands at least in London and all over Europe. There were people in several cities here in the United States who were demonstrating, and you could not find that at all on TV. So, and plus you didn't see a whole heck of a lot of coverage of the demonstration the day after, on Monday, the day after the pro-war demonstration, where you had at least as many people, if not more, than were at the pro-war demonstration getting arrested doing civil disobedience on Monday.
Yeah, including Cindy Sheehan, which should have been news.
Yeah, including Cindy Sheehan herself, and that should have been main headline news, and you couldn't find much mention of it at all.
I think one of the reasons for this is much of the agenda for the Beltway Press Corps is set by the people on Capitol Hill, and until we get Democrats, leading Democrats on the House, and this was part of what happened Monday also, was people who attended the demonstration on Saturday who weren't getting arrested were up in congressional offices lobbying the representatives. Mm-hmm. Until we start getting Democrats calling for the withdrawal of troops rather than sitting around trying to figure out what an exit strategy might be for the year 2010, we aren't going to get that reflected in the media coverage. The only thing we can really do at this point is just to turn out more people.
Yeah.
Isn't leading Democrats kind of an oxymoron?
Well, yeah. Well, you know what they say about if the people lead, the leaders will follow.
There you go. All right. Well, speaking of leaders, one of our local leaders, Greg Nichols, is getting a little flack this week. Maybe you could tell us where that's coming from and why.
He hired a midget for his PR department. No, it's a little flack. It's kind of a joke there. he got into trouble with the Seattle Election and Ethics Commission for sending out a glossy 8-page brochure in February in an election year, which basically, instead of touting the accomplishments of the city, which is what that publication is supposed to do, touted the accomplishments of Mayor Nichols. Now, we've all seen these kinds of flyers that the politicians send out, particularly in election years. The state legislative reps do it. McDermott does it from time to time, where they basically pimp themselves and talk about how wonderful their legislative accomplishments are. Well, this went a step or two beyond that. And the problem, particularly for Greg Nichols in this case, is that there is a history here where he had...
He used city resources. He used city personnel and city money
for material that's identical to the material that appears on his campaign website.
When he should have used his campaign funds to do it.
And there's a history here because complaints were filed against him. There weren't any complaints this year. This was something that the Ethics Commission initiated on their own. But in previous years, there had been complaints, and the Ethics Commission had ruled in favor of Nichols, but said that the only reason they were doing so was because it was not an election year, that that type of literature would be illegal on taxpayer money if it were an election year. So what does he do? He turns around and expands it during the election year, and now he's getting in trouble for it.
And there's not like he has a shortage of campaign funds either.
No, he's got a $500,000 in campaign funds compared to Al Runty, who's raised $7,000 so far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the flyer itself, they figured, costed something like $5,000. It wasn't like it was something that he couldn't have spent his campaign funds on. It was something that he just chose to use taxpayer money for. And that really points up what some of Mr. Nichols' priorities are. I took a look at the city budget because this last week he announced a revised budget. You know that we do a budget every 2 years in the city of Seattle for spending. The last biennial budget was for the 2005 to 2006 biennium. And usually when, you know, there's a big change in the money coming in, if there's less than they expect or more than they expect, they do a revised budget about halfway through that cycle. And that's what he's announced this past week, is a revised budget for 2006. And I took a little look at that. The revenue figures have changed because in 2005 they've gotten in a lot more money in sales tax and B&O tax, et cetera, than they expected, particularly a boost in the sales tax. And so basically they have to look at, okay, where are we going to spend the extra funds? What are we going to do with it? Are we going to put it in the reserve fund, et cetera? So I took a little peek at it, and what I noticed is they are putting more money to what Mayor Nichols assumes are the city's priorities. In other words, a big chunk of money to build about 6 blocks of new sidewalks, a bunch of money to paint bridges, for example, instead of to fix bridges, and money for new police and fire personnel. Now, the fire personnel, you can argue, are needed because there are some fire teams, fire squads that are understaffed. The fire department has made a good case for this. But 25 new police officers when violent crime is down seems to me to be pretty excessive until you look at the details of the budget and you see that Seattle Police Department has shifted a whole bunch of manpower, a whole bunch of detectives and other personnel to work on Homeland Security. So while Mayor Nichols is saying, well, we need more police, et cetera, he's not telling you it's going to be mostly to plug gaps created by shifts in personnel to Homeland Security.
Yeah. Although, to be fair, the police department has said for years that they've been understaffed. And they've shifted a lot of personnel out of street patrols and into these very specialized units, so they're really understaffed on street patrols.
Yeah, and those specialized units are primarily to deal with Homeland Security issues. And what I found interesting, one of the things that I was looking for when I was looking at this budget is to see whether any money had been shifted to emergency preparedness. There doesn't appear to be a big shift to emergency preparedness, although there does appear to be these shifts towards Homeland Security. And again, it's pointing up this issue of how likely are we to be hit by a terrorist attack versus an earthquake. I think an earthquake is a much, much more likely scenario, and I'm seeing a misalignment of priorities here.
Boy, especially coming after, you know, the multiple disasters, national disasters we've just had, you'd think that might figure into this.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and there's also been a number of reports, and we don't really have time to go into this right now, of the local emergency preparedness people not being prepared, that there really aren't good plans in place for how to deal with a major earthquake or other natural disaster.
It's a sign when the city council asks for a presentation from the city on emergency preparedness, and the mayor's office calls back the city council and cancels the presentation because they're not ready. Now, that'll tell you something
could you not have an earthquake today? We're not ready for it yet.
Yeah, about how prepared the city is to deal with something like this, you know.
Yeah, well, they're shoveling the dust off their previous plans.
Yeah.
So, moving along, the Boeing machinists look like they have voted to support a new contract.
Yeah, I thought the union did really well on this. Certainly, it was a successful strike. Now, you were saying before that some of the people you've had on this program were not particularly happy with the contract. What I've heard is that obviously the union was in favor of it. It was an 80% approval rate. Of course, some of that might have just been because they didn't want to go in for a long strike. But it's going to be very interesting because you've had this successful job action now, and now you've got the engineers coming up with a contract, and so Boeing's going to be under pressure to at least match that offer for the engineers who had a strike 5 years ago that shut down the company also.
Yeah, I had heard that between the contract that was turned down a month ago and this contract, there really wasn't very much difference, that the pensions had gotten a boost. But beyond that, it was pretty much exactly the same contract. So.
My understanding was that Boeing had wanted the workers to pay for some of their health care benefits. And that's a major chunk of change out of your monthly paycheck if you have that situation at your job place. And so winning the concession that Boeing would still be paying for their health care benefits, I think, is a major thing.
For pensioners also.
Yeah, and for pensioners also. And I think, too, that when Boeing said they wanted to cut the Wichita workers out of this deal, having the Seattle workers say, no, you cannot do that, and to win that concession of having the Wichita workers included in this deal, I think is a major boost for solidarity in the union. And I think it's great.
Yeah, well, I think there's no question that the union is better from having gone into this. But again, it's like, for instance, the 80% vote, I had heard from one of the union members that its announcement in the Washington Post at 11:09 p.m. that Pacific time, that the vote still hadn't been counted fully as of yet when they made that announcement. So, again, there's certainly not everyone's going to agree in situations like that, and you're going to have...
So a little controversy here.
There's, yeah. Clearly 20%, you know, if we believe that number, 20% voted against it. But probably I should pull them in and get the poop on this. All right. Anything else on that?
No. Let's move on.
All right. Let's move on to... Looks like we've got just national stuff left. Mr. Tom DeLay getting a lot of press coverage this week.
Excuse me. Yeah, he's in trouble. Tom DeLay got indicted by a Texas prosecutor named Ronnie Earle, who promptly got accused of being on a partisan witch hunt.
Slandered in the press.
Yeah, really slandered badly. Now, this is a guy who's been in office. He's on his eighth four-year term. He's been in office for over three decades. During that time, he's prosecuted 15 different elected office holders, 12 of whom have been Democrats. So he is probably one of the best positioned people in the country to be able to take on this type of controversial indictment. And the only reason it's controversial is because DeLay is so powerful. It's not as though the facts are in question in the case. DeLay funneled money from the national through the national Republican National Committee to Texas state legislative races so as to try and flip the Texas state legislature, which in turn led to the redistricting plan that put a bunch more Republicans into the House of Representatives nationally. So this is a national scandal. It's not just some local thing in Texas. This had implications for all national politics, and that's why it's such a big deal.
Yeah, and this comes at a time, too, when Bill Frist is under investigation by the SEC, he and his family company, for insider trading. So it really points up how, you know, we've talked a lot about how the Bush administration is violating the Geneva Conventions and supporting torture and detainment of people at Guantanamo Bay indefinitely and ignoring international law and breaking international treaties. But, you know, this is the fine print here. we're seeing that this goes all the way through the Republican Party, this kind of violation of law and thinking that you're above law at the same time.
Yeah, it's a real arrogance.
Yeah, it's incredible arrogance, and it's a kind of a culture of corruption. We like to talk about how third world governments, we can't give aid to third world countries because the governments are corrupt. Well, we have crony capitalism here. You know, I mean, you've got corporations giving Tom DeLay money that he sent to the National Republican Committee and then gave them a list of here are the people in Texas we want you to put this money to their campaigns in direct violation of Texas law. And at the same time, the Bush administration is doing their best to work against any campaign finance limits. I mean, here you've got. I mean, you can't point the finger at other countries and say, you know, corruption, and not expect to take the hit here at home. And that's what's happening.
And then in turn, the Texas law specifically forbids corporate contributions to state legislative races. And that's what this was corporate contributions. And it's the
funneled through the national committee.
And it's the quid pro quo. These corporations are expecting favorable treatment on the floor of Congress in exchange for their donations to national races, and they get that too in state races, I'm sure. But they were aware that this had national implications. That's why they made the contributions. And it really is corruption of the highest order when you have incumbents who face no real opposition getting huge amounts of money. We were talking about Mayor Nichols a little while ago also. It's not as though Democrats don't do this as well. But the national level, of course, you know, Republicans are in control of the White House and Congress. So they are the one party who has their hands on all the levers of power right now.
So, of course, we're not going to see any kind of impeachment call.
No, we're not. We would if there were...
If it were the Democrats.
If it were the Democrats, yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a real corruption of power that happens when you have one party with having so much dominance over all levels of the federal government right now. And the only way to change that is by voters to vote in Democrats and to have some sort of a balance between the two. It'd be wonderful if you had third parties that were powerful enough to offer a real challenge, but we don't have that right now, unfortunately.
You should, though.
Yeah.
But there are a multitude of ways in which the two main parties make it extremely difficult for third parties to get going.
That's very true.
And that needs to change as well.
So you think something will actually come of both the scandals with DeLay and Frist?
It almost doesn't matter whether it does or not, because it's the public perception that's going to be the important thing and whether people are voted out of office. And right now, you're having the imprimatur of corruption being tagged with the Republicans. And that's probably where the biggest damage is going to be. It almost doesn't matter whether DeLay gets sent to jail or not. I think he'll be indicted further. I think a lot of the associations with Jack Abramoff are going to bear fruit in terms of further indictments and arrests. We saw what was his name, David Saramoff, I think it was. Safravian, that was it. The former chief procurement officer for the federal government being arrested last week. He's another crony of Abramoff's, and this is somebody who is very, very closely associated with Tom DeLay.
All right. Well, moving along, it looks like this week that the Endangered Species Act is an endangered species.
Yeah, we had a...
That's just in the House. That looks like the Senate may not have a similar bill going through, and if it doesn't also pass the Senate, it can't become law.
Yeah, that's very true. We had a very bad bill pass the House of Representatives this week. There is a companion bill in the Senate. Chances are uncertain. But,
dead in committee, I think.
It would be a wonderful time to ask our Democratic senators to make sure that it doesn't proceed. But it's also indicative of more and more momentum on the side of people who want to dismantle the Endangered Species Act. This is a piece of legislation that would basically require the federal government to reimburse property owners for damages incurred or lost earnings. It's basically takings legislation for lost earnings as a result of the Endangered Species Act, and it also puts political appointees in charge of some of the scientific findings that determine whether a species is endangered or not. It's a really bad piece of legislation all the way around, and this is something we're going to be seeing more of.
Yeah, although it may be harder for it to get passed now that Tom DeLay, who used to whip the Republicans in line in the House, is out of there now.
Yeah, that is
a little bit of a bright star.
Yeah,
on the
one of the other practical implications of DeLay's having to step down as House Majority Leader is party discipline, and not just in terms of how Republicans vote on the floor of the Congress, but also in terms of discipline of the K Street lobbyists and the corporate donors to the party, because he had them all lined up also.
And then what bills get advanced through committee and make it to the floor, and how the floor votes go, what amendments get tacked on to bills, and whether or not the Republican Party in the House adheres to George Bush's, what he outlines as his priorities, too. That's the big role that someone like Tom DeLay plays in a place like the House, is keeping all that in line and keeping all that going. When he's out of there, it could be very, very difficult for George Bush to get a lot of his priorities through Congress.
Particularly when Bush is as politically wounded as he is right now.
Yeah.
Briefly, you had mentioned our two Democratic senators, and they had, of course, this week been split on John Roberts' nomination. So,
yeah, which I found kind of disgusting.
I liked Maria. Vote was...
Maria Cantwell did the right thing. She talked to her constituents. She talked to people who had some knowledge of Supreme Court issues, and she outlined a reason for voting against Roberts. Patty Murray, on the other hand, ignored her constituents, and she said, I'm going to vote my personal belief on this issue, essentially. That's what she said.
I'm not sure that Patty Murray has personal beliefs. just between...
I found that pretty odious myself, you know, that she happens to like the guy, so she thinks he's okay, and didn't give any particular reason why she thought, you know, he was okay. Just that, you know, personally, I think he's a nice guy. Isn't gonna cut it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are a lot of people that are nice guys, or who can put on the appearance of being nice guys. That's not one of the reasons to give them one of the most powerful jobs in the country
for
life.
Yeah, and that's what John Roberts is known for, is putting on a really good appearance. And people tend to say, well, I don't honestly know what John Roberts believes because he's so smooth. He's a salesman type.
All right. Well, that jumps us over to international and This Week in Iraq.
This Week in Iraq.
The big news on Iraq this week is a U.S. Army captain and two sergeants told Human Rights Watch and then a Senate Armed Services Committee that U.S. troops in Iraq are still routinely beating and abusing prisoners. Now, Captain Ian Fishback had contacted the Senate Armed Service Committee within the past 2 weeks because his superior officers at the Pentagon had failed to respond to his repeated complaints. He said that he witnessed Iraqi prisoners being stripped, beaten, deprived of sleep, food, and water, and exposed to extremes of heat and cold. The two sergeants who talked to Human Rights Watch, they said that they've witnessed beatings and broken bones. They said the beatings were daily, the broken bones were routine, and inflicted by U.S. troops. He says, as were efforts to humiliate prisoners, and they said that it went on in places other than Abu Ghraib, that in fact, as Ian Fishback said, the problem was systemic and it was widespread. Captain Fishback and the two sergeants were all members of the 82nd Airborne Division, one of the oldest and most decorated divisions in the Army. So these guys were obviously not Army Reserve, you know, teenagers or people just barely out of their teens with almost no training. Yeah, with almost no training sent over to Iraq, as the Army has been arguing with the folks who have been tried and convicted in the Abu Ghraib scandal. These, you know, Fishback and the two sergeants are talking about people who are, you know, career military in heavily units that have seen a lot of combat. They also said that these techniques that they used, In other words, you know, beating, stripping prisoners, humiliating them, pouring chemicals on their skin to burn their skin, etc. These were all techniques that they learned in Afghanistan from CIA interrogators, and then they moved them over to the detention facilities in Iraq. So not only is it systematic, it's something that obviously the Army and the CIA were using as a tool and knew that they were using as a tool, and it's something that probably came down from on high.
And not just using as a tool. This isn't something that's happening just in terms of trying to get information out of interrogated prisoners, but also something that's being done simply for the amusement of guards.
Well, I don't know that that's necessarily the case. I mean, that was the case at Abu Ghraib, but also you heard in the defense arguments for the people who were being tried in the Abu Ghraib scandal that these guys were doing these techniques because the military interrogators and the CIA interrogators were telling them that they needed them to soften up the detainees. And in fact, that's exactly what Fishback and the two sergeants said as well, that these techniques were being used. Certainly some sadistic jerks get some pleasure out of this, but these techniques were being used to soften up prisoners, and they are definitely a violation of the Geneva Conventions. Now, U.S. troops were also caught this week posting pictures of dead Iraqis on the internet in exchange for access to a pornography website. Some troops evidently couldn't pay for access to the pornography website, and so the owner of the website took as payment pictures of dead Iraqis. Some of them were insurgents. Some of them may have been civilians. Many of them were posted with taglines, extremely racist taglines, that said things like what every Iraqi should look like next to the body of a dead person. That's something that I think the Army needs to do something about. However, they haven't, and they don't apparently see this as a scandal. In fact, it hasn't hit the newspapers here in the U.S. It's been widely reported in the U.K. In addition, a federal judge this week ordered the release of 74 photos and 3 videos depicting abuse at Abu Ghraib, photos and videos that the Pentagon has been trying to bury because it doesn't want the U.S. public to see what the U.S. military is doing in Iraq. The judge, on the other hand, said that he had ruled in favor of the release because he said it's in the public interest for people to see this. It would initiate debate on the conduct of U.S. soldiers in Iraq, on their training, and on the Army command's responsibility. However, the Pentagon has 20 days to appeal this ruling, and you better believe they're going to do that. At the same time, I noticed this week that the LA Times had reported in an article on Monday. The article was entitled "Missteps Hamper Iraqi Oil Recovery," that the U.S. has so mismanaged the rebuilding of the Iraqi oil infrastructure that we may have done permanent damage to the world's second largest oil reserves. The Southern Oil, from engineering mistakes, poor supervision and maintenance, inexperienced personnel, that's inexperienced U.S. personnel going over to manage the reconstruction, disputes with U.S. subcontractors like Kellogg Brown and Root and Halliburton, that all of these mistakes have led to possibly doing permanent damage to the oil wells and the oil reservoirs in both the southern and northern parts of the country.
And this is pretty astonishing, because you would think this is something that we would know how to do well.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the estimates were that Iraq could have extracted something like 35% to 60% of its oil reserves if the reconstruction had gone according to plan. Now the estimate is somewhere around 15% to 25% and may actually be lower than that. Now, the northern oil fields are in particularly bad shape because of sabotage to the export pipelines. Once you start an oil well going, you can't really stop it easily. You have to keep pumping the oil out of the ground. Well, if you can't export the oil and you have limited storage capacity, you have to do something with that oil that just keeps coming out of the ground. Well, what Iraqi engineers have been forced to do is pump it right back into the ground. So they're pumping this heavy oil right back into the oil wells in order to keep the oil wells producing and to store it somehow. What that does is that plugs up all the cracks and fissures in the ground, and it fouls up the whole system and it can destroy an oil well. Well, you know, I find it ironic that the Bush administration you know, that is probably the main reason why they invaded Iraq in the first place, was to extract the oil. Well, even that plan has been a failure.
Well, with that, we are out of time. Talking once again with Joe Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And quickly, where can people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks. It's a volunteer newspaper with all kinds of local and global news and information and comics and good stuff. You find it where you find free publications of all kinds, cafes, bookstores, places like that. And on the web, www.eatthestate.org. If you have questions, comments, tips, you want to volunteer, give us a call. Phone number, area code 206-719-6947.